listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. We are welcoming back Salman Rushdie, who was here in 2012 to receive the Los Angeles Public Library Literary Award. Salman Rushdie is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters and a distinguished writer in residence at NYU. He's a former director, president of American Pen, and he was knighted in 2007 for services to literature. In conversation with Salman Rushdie tonight is Hector Tobar, who is, like Salman, an author of both novels and nonfiction. Hector Tobar's most recent book, Deep Down Dark, The Untold Stories of 33 Men Buried in a Chilean Mine and the Miracle That Set Them Free, which you can hear about in more detail at the Last Bookstore this weekend, is being released as a film very soon, and we're delighted to welcome Hector back. He won a Pulitzer Prize during his tenure at the LA Times, and it's a great thrill to have him back at Aloud as well. In Salman Rushdie's new novel, his 12th, the mischievous forces of disorder take advantage of the weakening fabric of the everyday, which is something we might wonder all the time. Is reality coming unglued? Has it already? Melting glaciers, fanatics' jackhammers and dynamite blowing up Buddhas and ancient Greco-Roman temples in the desert. The word jinn comes from the Persian language and means literally hidden from sight, from the Arabic root meaning to hide or to be hidden. In Rushdie's novel, sometime in the near future, a storm has reopened the slits between the earth and the jinn-filled realm above. As those formerly hidden reveal themselves, reason is pitted against fear-based religious fervor, and havoc reigns for 1,001 nights. After all, the jinns create havoc because it is their nature. Strange things begin to happen. In a French town, the citizens begin to turn into rhinoceroses. In a Romanian village, a woman starts to lay eggs. Everywhere, humans have to be on their guard against the dangers of the jinn. There's fear in the air in this ingenious novel that melds fable and history. There's also magic and humor. I should mention this book is quite funny. Salman Rushdie was trained as a historian, and he's always been fascinated with the different ways we tell stories, how we understand what happened, what's happening, and what may happen in the future. Tonight, you'll also learn about Rushdie's connection to another great thinker, Ibn Rushd, who wrote in the golden Islamic age in Andalus and was one of the, quote, founding fathers of secular thought in Western Europe, or as James Joyce called him in Ulysses, a darkness shining in brightness, which brightness could not comprehend. And please join me in welcoming to the stage Salman Rushdie and Hector Tobar. Thank you.
We're gonna work our way up into the reading. But thank you all for coming. Thank you for coming to this wonderful venue, our premier literary arts venue in Los Angeles. Salman has written a book that is about the end of the world, and so we ordered up end of the world weather for him. This is not usual. Salman, I wanted to start off with asking what I think is sort of, for me, question zero for or question one for Salman Rushdie. You know, you have this amazing power of invention you've sort of showcased through so many novels. And of course, it's so evident in this one, Midnight's Children. You use this power of invention of the fantastic melded with the very concrete and the real in Midnight's Children to untangle the history of the birth of India. And I'm wondering, now that we're seeing this used to untangle our present very messy, cruel reality, Where does this power or this, you know, this desire to invent in this fantastical way, where does it come from? Is it something that you developed professionally as a writer when you first thought about writing, or is it something that goes back to Kashmir? Does it go back to India? Where do you think that this comes from? This, you know, this desire.
I don't know. I mean, I'm just. It's what I do. But it's true. First of all, I came from a family of enormously noisy people. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, everybody in my family talked a great deal. And in order to be heard, you had to have something interesting to say. So, I mean, I had three sisters and no brothers, and a lot more women than men in my extended family of aunts and cousins and so on, and they all talked nonstop. So I guess I first of all learned something about storytelling just as somebody living in my family, you know. I mean, my father was good at telling versions of the great stories. So, you know, my first experience of Arabian Night stories and so on was in my father's, not he didn't read them, he just told his own versions of them. But the women in my family told wicked stories about everybody. And they knew where all the bodies were buried, you know. In fact, there was a point where my mother said to me, I'm going to stop telling you this stuff because you put it in your books and I get in trouble. But, of course, she didn't stop telling me. So I think there's something which just comes out of family, you know. And then I think it was a great, I think it's a great good fortune to those of us who grow up in South Asia, you know, that you have this incredible storehouse of wonderful tales, you know, that surround you. The Arabian Nights is only the most famous, but there are many others. And actually, one of the strange things about the Arabian Nights is, though everybody thinks of it as the Arabian Nights, most of the stories in it actually originated in India. Mm. You know, these stories have made a remarkable journey. Most of them started as Indian stories. At a certain point, they were translated into Farsi, to Persian, because that was the court language. Mm. And there's this collection. There was this book called the Hazar Afsana, which means the Thousand Stories, in which the story of Shahrazad first appeared. Mm. That book has been completely lost. Not a single copy of it survives. And the only reason we even know that it existed is because it's referred to in other books. Mm. Anyway, that book journeyed from India into the Persian-speaking world, and then through the Persian-speaking world into the Arab world, where it was translated into the book which was called Alf Layla Wa Layla, The Thousand Nights and One Night. And on each of those steps of the journey, certain stories fell out and other stories fell in. You know, so in a way, there is no text. There's no canonical text. It was constantly changing. And then at a certain point, it moved from the Arabic language. Actually, when it came to Europe, it went to French. And in the French translation, which was done by a man called Antoine Galland, he again removed some of the stories and put in many of the stories that you all know, like Aladdin,
yes,
you know, and Ali Baba, were basically invented by this French dude who put them in there and said that they were part of what was called the Arabian Nights entertainment. So these stories have moved across the world, you know, and at a certain point they arrived in Latin America and actually had a very big influence on Latin American literature, you know. So the point is, it all starts from India, you know.
It does.
All of this. So to grow up with this was a great gift to me as a writer, you know. And I've noticed just in these few days that I've been talking about the book, in the days leading up to the publication and since, that one of the questions I seem to be getting asked a lot is, you know, why didn't you tell this story realistically? Mm. And I thought, what kind of a question is that, you know? That's like asking a painter who's done something, like, you know, looking at Picasso's Blue Period and saying, why didn't you paint it in red? Mm. I mean, I didn't because I didn't. You know? I didn't do that because I did this. And it just seems to me that that question comes out of a moment, I think, in particularly the literature of the English language, but not only, where nonfiction has become much more popular than fiction. Mm-hmm. And where even the kind of fiction that is having its moment right now is very non-fictional. You know, the kind of Knausgård, mm-hmm. Elena Ferrante,
yes,
kind of fiction, which appears to contain very, very large, detailed descriptions coming directly from the author's life experience. You know, and that, what in France was called autofiction.
Yes.
You know, that, and the mixture of autobiography and fiction. That seems to be where the action is right now. And so I find that I've done something fantastically unfashionable.
So you haven't had personally any genies appear in the wall of your bedroom, as in this novel? That has not happened to you? Or are you saying it's all made up? Is that?
I don't think I should answer that question. Because, you know, genies get pissed off. I have met one genuine genie, which is that there was a point where I became quite friendly with Robin Williams.
Oh.
So, you know. And I mean, he told me this wonderful story about mm-hmm. that role.
Playing that role, yes.
Yeah, which that initially it was quite, it wasn't a big role. Mm. And he was brought into the sound studio essentially as a kind of day player, you know, to do this relatively small. And so he did it. And then he said to them, he said, look, you know, I think there's just some more here.
Yes.
And can I just have a go? You know, can I just see where I... And so they let him, because they're not idiots.
Yes.
and he just went, you know. And the result of that day in the studio was so remarkable that they had to really reanimate the film in order to make the genie a much bigger part. Mm. And when I had dinner at his house once, and he said, you know, afterwards... He said, you know, the Disney people, they made a lot of money from that film. And, mm-hmm. and they were a little embarrassed because I hadn't been paid that much. And he said, so they gave me a present. He took me to the dining room, and hanging over the mantelpiece of the dining room was a Picasso oil painting. And he said, that's what they gave me.
I thought you said they were going to give, it was an urn, you know.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I know. Well, anyway, so I did.
A lamp.
I knew one genie, yeah.
Well, in this story, we have the fantastical, but then there are perhaps this question about realism has something to do with the fact that you have two concrete, actual historical figures yeah. who help set off the story. Mm-hmm. And one is Ibn Rushd, yes, if I've pronounced yes. that correctly, yeah. known in the English-speaking world as Averroes, mm-hmm. yes, who a thinker from the 12th century, from the Islamic Golden Age, an admirer of Aristotle. He actually also makes a cameo in James Joyce's Ulysses, mm-hmm. Very briefly. He represents reason in the story and I think in history. When did you become, and I know you grew up with this idea that yeah. your family name came from his family name.
Yeah, my father admired his thinking so much that he changed our family surname. You know, my grandfather wasn't called Rushdie, you know. Mm-hmm. My father decided that would be our family name. And so eventually, you know, when I was growing up, I was told this story. And of course, it made me very interested, curious about his thought. And so I started reading. I mean, you know, it's serious philosophy. So I didn't read it as a kid. But as I grew up, I started reading it and discovered that I was very attracted to his thought in exactly the same way as my father had been, you know, because in his time, the 12th century in Spain, he was very much, you know, a kind of progressive voice. So he was somebody who spoke, who wrote in favor of privileging reason and logic and science over blind faith. Mm. And he was attacked for it. And then later on when, I mean, you may be aware of the fact that somebody attacked me once.
Yes, I heard of that, yeah, yes.
But, well, when that
although
happened,
we're not really supposed to be talking about that very much.
Yeah, but when that happened, I realized that the same thing had happened to him.
Yes.
That he had had a period when he had been exiled, and he'd been very eminent. He'd been not just the court philosopher, but he'd been the personal physician of the Sultan. And then he was cast out and sent into exile, and all his books were burned. Mm. So I thought, well, I know something about that.
Yes. You know,
All that interest meant that I thought one of these days I'm going to have to write about him. And what I didn't realize is that I was going to have him fall in love with a supernatural princess.
Well, before we get to that, which is interesting because it involves sex. Always interesting thing. He has a rival who exists, who was his contemporary rival,
yeah.
Ghazali. Yeah. Who is who speaks in this very familiar way about the supremacy of God and how he says that the followers of truth know that it is reason and science that are the true juvenilia of the human mind. Faith is our gift from God, and reason is our adolescent rebellion against it.
Mm. Yes. Mm. So, yeah, well, I mean, Ghazali was religious conservative. Yes. And a great deal of what one might now call fundamentalism comes out of that kind of thinking. He was a very, very influential philosopher, and he was actually in many ways more influential than Ibn Rushd inside the Islamic tradition.
Yes.
Strangely, Ibn Rushd became very influential outside the Islamic tradition. You know, he became very influential in the European philosophical tradition. I mean, Thomas Aquinas was very influenced by him, and even the French, the Italian Renaissance humanists were very influenced by him. So, you know, oddly, he found his inheritors outside his own tradition. But Ghazali wrote this book called The Incoherence of the Philosophers.
Yes.
Which was an attack on philosophy for being full of shit, basically.
Yes. You know?
And Ibn Rushd wrote a reply to it, a book with this very beautiful title. Mm-hmm. It was called The Incoherence of the Incoherence. and I actually almost called this book The Incoherence of the Incoherence because I thought it was such a great title. And then I thought, you know, that's like handing the weapon to the critic.
Yes.
You know, it's like putting the baseball bat in the guy's hand so that he can use that against you, say, over the course of the book is totally incoherent, etc. So that came into under the heading of Not Born Yesterday. You know, so I thought, don't do that. But I almost did.
So you imagine them, the novel, towards the beginning, you imagine them...
Disputing.
Yes, disputing in Cordoba. They both were in Cordoba.
No. I mean, actually, they lived, you know...
Far apart. Yes.
They never met.
They never met.
But I imagined them having this dispute.
Right. And then you introduce this force, this jinn. Her name is Dunya.
Yes.
And she has decided... She's gradually falling in love with the idea of the human race.
Yes.
As this possessors of passions that she doesn't quite understand... The humans were like this fly speck in terms of their time because they live many millennia.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But she falls for...
The human race in general.
And she falls Ibn
Rushd in particular. And has legendary numbers of children by him.
Yes.
I mean, you know, like 7 the first time, 19 the third time. But he never suspects that she's in any sense supernatural because he's a little bit self-absorbed.
Yes, as many men are, and especially writers and especially intellectuals, yes.
Actually, again, I have to just clarify one thing, which is, and again, you know, you learn about your book from the questions people ask
yes.
you on the road, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions I've been asked a few times now mm-hmm. is, so, your book, it begins with this old guy whose name is very similar to yours, and this young woman, very beautiful,
yes.
knocks at his door, and wants to be his lover, and why would that be? You know, and so I had to point out that actually, although she presents herself to him as a young woman,
yes.
she's actually incredibly old.
Yes.
In fact, at one point she says that she remembers the dinosaurs. You know, so she's millions of years old, and that makes him her boy toy.
Right, exactly. And a smart one, too, which is rare.
Yeah, and yes. a smart one. She's unlike most people looking for boy toys, she likes smart people.
So. Now, growing up, genie...
Just making it clear.
I knew the word genie, because there's a I Dream of Genie.
Yes, there was a moment in the book where I got terrified that I was rewriting I Dream of Genie. Because it's about, you know, a genie female person who falls
yes.
in love with a human being, and I thought, it's Larry Hagman, you know? It's
yes. Yes, so you got the anti-Larry Hagman.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Philosopher. And most of us, for me, I did not know, I only knew the word jinn from Scrabble. It's a great Scrabble word because
yeah.
it has a J in it. So why introduce, you know, what's the inspiration for this particular, I don't know, race of beings or this particular kind of being? To bring them into the story. What was the
inspiration? What I wanted to do was to dramatize a world, not just a world that's out of control, mm-hmm. a world in which these things are taking place, which are called strangenesses.
Yes.
You know, where, but that there's a malevolent force at work, and the great thing about the jinn, if you do the reading about them, is that they have no relationship to religion. You know, they're right. Pre-religious. These are very old narratives. And so it's just a way of saying here are two kinds of being, that's us and these others, who are in conflict. And that conflict allowed me to, I thought, to dramatize a lot of the craziness of this time, you know. And they just helped. They helped. And they were funny. And funny is good.
Yes. And you talk about the strangenesses. That's this the time of strangenesses. There is a hurricane. There are these malevolent right-wing forces. It sounds a lot like the time that we're living in. I thought Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah, well, I mean, yes. I was in New York during the hurricane and in the dark part of town, you know, below 46th Street. And so, the hurricane in the book is a kind of super version of that. But yes, it helped. It certainly helped me to think about it, to have been there. I remember, parenthetically, that after the hurricane, there were these aerial photographs published of Manhattan in darkness, mm-hmm. or the bottom half of Manhattan in darkness. And in one of the pictures, I saw that the whole city was in darkness, except down in the financial district, there's one building that was brilliantly illuminated, and that was Goldman Sachs. And I thought, you know, you can't make this stuff up. You know, it's kind of... It sort of reveals, just that single image tells us more about the times we live in than anything else. Anyway, so, yeah, it started, I wanted something, you know, because the idea is that, the djinn are in these very old stories, mm-hmm. but they haven't been around lately you know, in stories. So I had the idea that over the centuries, the kind of passageways, the gateways between these two worlds had got blocked up, you know, they'd got silted up. And so there had not been any intercourse between these worlds for some time. Mm. And so the suggestion is that then these enormous natural phenomena, these storms, had had opened the doors, you know, had sort of broken open the seals. And so these creatures could come in and start messing around with us.
And they are the descendants of Dunya and Ibn Rushd. That's the...
Because they had all these kids, you know, 7 and 11 and 19, whatever that is, and possibly more. Mm-hmm. Those kids dispersed around the world and had descendants. And the way you recognize them is that none of them have earlobes. Mm-hmm. That's the mark of the clan. And actually, that's also something that I stole, because the actual people who don't have earlobes was the Habsburg dynasty.
Oh, right.
Which ruled Europe for a long time. If you look at all the paintings of the Habsburgs, they've got no earlobes. So I pinched that. Anyway, so there they are. And then at the point at which the so-called dark djinn, the wicked ones, come through and start trying to wreak mayhem, the princess Dunya, whose offspring are now everywhere on Earth, you know,
yes,
comes back to defend them, mm-hmm. and so there follows this thing which is called the War of the Worlds. But in many ways, it's not only a war between the worlds, but it's also a civil war, mm-hmm. amongst the djinn, you know, good and bad.
Now, there's one particular descendant who you give this wonderful vocation to. He's a gardener.
He's a gardener.
Mr. Geronimo, yes?
Yes.
And he, which is a Latinization or Anglicization of a South Asian name, yes?
Well, by origin, he's Indian Christian. And he was born in Bombay, like me, but in the Christian area of Bandra. And he was called Raphael Hieronymus, was his middle name.
Yes.
And when he came to America, Hieronymus turned into Geronimo. And he kind of quite liked it, because it had this kind of Indian chief illusion. You know, and if you're an Indian, you know, dot, not feather, as they say, it was quite attractive to be mistaken for an Indian who is feather, not dot.
And he has this particular condition that starts to affect him. And you're going to read a passage.
But there's a thing, terrible thing that happens to him, given that he's somebody who spent his life loving the earth, mm-hmm. and nurturing, growing things in the ground, which is that he comes detached from it. Let me just read you a little bit about this. So he's gone at this point. There's this big estate that where he works as a landscape gardener, just outside, just across the George Washington Bridge in New Jersey. And he's there in the aftermath of the hurricane where the estate has been badly damaged by the overflowing river and there's mud everywhere and so on. And he's surveying the wreckage of many years of his work. And it says it was there on those formerly rolling lawns, hidden now beneath the black mud from the swollen Hudson. As weeping a little, he surveyed the ruin of more than a decade of his best landscaping work. The stone spirals that echoed the Iron Age Celts, the sunken garden which put its Floridian cousin in the shade, the analemma sundial, a replica of the one at the Greenwich Meridian, the rhododendron forest, the Minoan labyrinth with the fat stone minotaur at its heart, the secret hedge-hidden nooks, all of them lost and broken beneath the black mud of history. The tree roots standing up in the black mud like the arms of drowning men. It was there that Mr. Geronimo understood that his feet had developed a significant new problem. He stepped out onto the mud, and his boots neither squelched nor stuck. He took two or three bewildered steps across the blackness and looked back and saw that he had left no footprints. Damn, he cried aloud in consternation. What kind of world had the tempest flung him into? Mr. Geronimo didn't think of himself as being easily scared, but the missing footprints had him spooked. He stamped down hard, left boot, right boot, left boot. He jumped up and came down as heavily as he could. The mud was unmoved. Had he been drinking? No, though on occasion he did overdo things, as an older man living alone sometimes does. And why not? But this time alcohol was not a factor. Was he still asleep and dreaming of the estate lost beneath a mud sea? Maybe, but this didn't feel like a dream. Was this some unworldly river-bottom mud? Some river monsterish mud, previously unknown to mud scientists, whose deep-water mystery gave it the power to resist the weight of a leaping man? Or, and this felt the most plausible, though also the most alarming possibility, had there been a change in himself? Some inexplicable personal gravitational lessening. Jesus, he thought, and also at once thought of his father, the priest, frowning at the blasphemy, his father berating his child self from 2 feet away as if threatening his congregation from his pulpit with his weekly fire and brimstone. He would really have to get those feet looked at now. Mr. Geronimo was a down-to-earth man, and so it did not occur to him that a new age of the irrational had begun. In which the gravitational aberration to which he had fallen victim would be only one of many outre manifestations. Further bizarreries in his own narrative were beyond his comprehension. It did not enter his mind, for example, that in the near future he might make love to a fairy princess. Nor did the transformation of global reality preoccupy him. He drew no broader conclusions from his plight. He did not imagine the imminent reappearance in the oceans of sea monsters large enough to swallow ships in a single gulp, or the emergence of men strong enough to lift fully grown elephants, or the appearance in the skies over the earth of wizards traveling through the air at super speed on magically propelled flying urns. He did not surmise that he could have fallen under the spell of a mighty and malevolent djinn. However, he was methodical by nature. And so undeniably concerned by his new condition, he reached into a pocket of his battered gardening jacket and found a folded sheet of paper, a bill from the power utility company. The power had been shut down, but the bills continued to insist on prompt settlement. That was the natural order of things. He unfolded the bill and spread it out on the mud. Then he stood on it, stamped and jumped some more, tried to rub the document with his feet. It remained untouched. He reached down and tugged at it, and at once it slid out from beneath his feet with no trace of a footprint. He tried a second time and was able to pass the utility bill cleanly under both boots. The gap between himself and the earth was tiny but unarguable. He was now permanently located, at least a sheet of paper's thickness above the planet's surface.
It's then wonderful. It gets worse. Thank you.
Now, if you think about it, being this far off the ground is as great a violation of the law of gravity as if you were 20 feet off the ground. But it's, you know, funnier.
The magic of understatement. So I love you describe these New Yorkers' reactions initially to his condition. And there are many people who believe that it's some sort of trick.
It's a scam.
It's a scam that he's got pulling off, yes.
Yeah, I mean, stop it. You know? I mean, you did that yesterday. You know, you don't have to go on doing it.
Yes.
We get it. You got a trick, you know.
But and, yes.
But it actually allows him to continue to live in his own neighborhood because nobody takes it seriously.
Nobody takes it seriously, yes.
Everybody thinks, oh, he's that guy pretending to float.
But there's so many more odd manifestations, and my favorite is the mayor who the baby is presented to the mayor. There's a baby.
I'm very fond of the storm special, baby.
Storm baby.
There's this foundling, you know, this foundling child wrapped in the flag of India, which is abandoned at the office of the mayor of New York, who is female. Big improvement on the current mayor of New York, and she turns out to have the power, not only of identifying corruption, but of actually inflicting corruption on the corrupt, so that when she's in the presence of the corruption, their skin starts to rot.
Sort of like a Pinocchio effect, yes.
Pinocchio, but more
the skin.
But
yes.
But you know, Pinocchio didn't make people rot.
Yes.
this is the most savage Pinocchio.
Yes.
Anyway, but I love her. You know, she grows up to be a Supreme Court judge. and nobody can ever lie in court because they start rotting.
But this is just the prologue.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. To this amazing...
Yeah, then it gets really strange.
Yes, it gets really strange. And also, there are many characters who seem to me taken from the pages of Page Six, you know, New York Post.
Really?
Larger-than-life New York types.
Wow.
You know,
which
stockbrokers.
Oh.
You know, those kinds of people, famous
people.
Well,
I wanted to have a kind of galaxy of New York types.
No, I mean, of course, there's down-to-earth people. There's the comic artist.
Yeah, yeah. But there is a particularly horrible Wall Street guy. Yeah. And there's even a surprise appearance by Donald Trump. Which I must say I'm very proud of, because it was long before he became the Donald Trump that we now love so much. It's when he was just some random asshole, you know. But, to be able to foretell the intrusion of Donald Trump into the world.
Donald Trump is a Page Six character.
Yes, he is.
Yes.
Yes.
And I couldn't help thinking, as I was reading this, knowing that having read Joseph Anton, that you were one of those few novelists who has been transported into that world of celebrity. And, you know, I was wondering if you drew on any of those experiences of being in that.
I've met a lot of people, you know. And I think one of the great things about, for a novelist, is to try and meet as many different kinds of people as you can, you know. I mean, if you think of the great novelists, the people like Dickens and Thackeray and so on, they were able to make portraits from the entire spectrum of society, you know. From the lowest to the highest, from the grandest to the humblest, you know, with a degree of knowledge and conviction, you know. And I think I've always thought it's part of the writer's job to try and enter as many worlds as possible, you know. Try and be there, try and see what goes on. And because I think the novel is the least ivory tower of forms.
Yes.
You know, it's a form about how people actually are. And what they're really thinking about. What is the language in their heads? What is preoccupying them? You know, what bugs them? And the more you get around, you know, the broader your canvas becomes. And so, yeah, I'm quite, you know, I think it is true that I've, through the accidents of my life, got to meet quite a few people. I mean, it's helped in the past, not just in this book. I mean, for instance, when I was writing my novel, Shalimar the Clown, one of the major characters in that book is a very powerful American diplomat, politician. You know? And one of the things that happened to me, which was unexpected, but because of the things that happened in my life, is I got to meet a lot of politicians, including American ones. And it gave me material or it gave me, if you like, the confidence that I could make one up.
Yes.
In some credible way, you know, because I'd seen a lot of them behaving.
Yes. Up close.
Some well, some not so well. And I have to say, the most boring politician I ever met was Bob Dole. I was once stranded in a departure lounge in D.C. with Bob Dole because there was a snowstorm. Mm. And we were stuck there for, I mean, it was probably 2 hours, but it felt like weeks. And he spoke in this absolutely unbroken monotone about the dullest things in the world. So he said to me things like, that I saw you recently on television. I said, yeah, I was on television. I was on the Charlie Rose show. And he said, I have been on the Charlie Rose show. He's a very interesting man and a very good interviewer, I think. And we spoke about many subjects. And this was like hours of this.
Hours like this.
By the end of the day, you want to kill yourself. I just thought, you know, if that man had ever become president, he would have bored America's enemies into submission. It would just have surrendered just to shut him up.
Well, on the other end of the spectrum of your personal experience... There is you. I feel in this particular, these sentences that I'm going to read, I feel Salman in the middle of the fury of the storm circa.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this is a scene deeper in the book where a mob gathers outside the home of this one particular figure. The gathering mob, words of hate. And this to me, it sounds like certain cable channels. Aggression disguised as defensiveness. The threatening claiming to be under threat. The knife pretending to be in danger of being stabbed. The fist accusing the chin of attacking it. All that was familiar. The loud, malevolent hypocrisy of the age.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, what is interesting about that particular character, who is English,
mm-hmm.
Is that a lot of people have suggested to me that it was based on Christopher Hitchens, which it wasn't.
No.
The person I was actually thinking about was the British playwright Harold Pinter, who was also formidable with a terrifying bad temper.
Mm.
And when I was thinking about this is a character in the novel who is a composer called Hugo Casterbridge, who gets into various kinds of trouble. But he is kind of irascible and opinionated. So was Christopher. But I wasn't actually thinking about Christopher. I was thinking about somebody else. But there we are. Maybe Christopher subliminally snuck in and took over the character.
But in the novel, the mob is mad at him in part because of something that's happened. He's been taken over.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, mobs are mobs, and I do think that it is part of the great hypocrisy of the age that people are constantly claiming to be offended when they're doing the offensive thing. And the upside-downness of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people claiming to be victims when they're in fact victimizing. You know, Kim Davis.
Yes.
You know, for example, claiming to have been deprived of her rights when in fact she's depriving other people of theirs.
Exactly.
You know, this kind of inverted morality, that people saying the opposite of the truth and claiming it to be the truth. It's a feature of our time.
And in the novel, it's something that might already be present in the world of the novel, but the evil, the dark djinn, they stoke this in the world.
Yeah, because it's their nature.
It's their nature.
Now, one of the things about the djinn, you see, is that the djinn have an ambiguous relationship towards human beings. On the one hand, they are much more interested in human beings than they like to admit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because human beings are more interesting than they are.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't do that much. They just have sex.
Yes.
You know, and I wanted them to have one characteristic which was colossally exaggerated and ludicrous.
Mm-hmm.
And what ended up being is sex. That there's not that much to do in the djinn world. You know, there's no books to read. There's no literature in fairyland. There's no movies to watch. So all they do is inexhaustibly have sex, and it gets dull after a few thousand years. And they like human beings because we do other things than have sex. We might envy them, but they envy us. But so they come along, they get involved in the earth, you know, rather like the Greek gods used to meddle in human affairs. Yes. And take sides and make trouble, so on. But they do it because they're interested, you know. But then because it's their nature to screw things up, they screw things up.
But in this case, too, it's also a kind of proxy war, right? Because Ghazali and Ibn Rushd, they have this rivalry that goes back to the 12th century.
Yes, and they somehow live on beyond. I mean, what happened is that when I was writing the book, I thought that this little altercation between these two 12th century philosophers would be there as a kind of little prologue to the book.
Yes.
You know, and then the book would leap almost nine centuries to the present day, and you'd have the novel. But once I started them arguing with each other, I kind of liked it. And I thought, this is good, you know, and it's useful. And I want to find a way of letting them go on arguing, even though they've been dead for 900 years. And so I brought them back to life, like in their graves, as dust, and the argumentative dust. In 1,000 miles apart from each other, the argumentative dust goes on arguing with itself. So they go on having this dispute, which I think is one of the great disputes of our time.
Yes, know? Yes. Yes.
And so that's why it was useful to have it there as a kind of little, as a little recurring motif in the book.
You know, I found it as someone who, you know, not really well read in Arabic history, the history of Arabic thought, the idea that these debates that we think of as beginning the Enlightenment, to, you know, go back further, you know, much further.
Well, that's sort of, in a way, one of the other answers to the question of why not write this as a realistic novel is that I was trying to reach just a little bit under the news, if you know what I mean, and to say that this is, yes, at the moment there's a particularly ugly confrontation that we all know about and is in the news every day. But I wanted to reach below that and say that, you know, it's not just, this didn't just happen.
Yes.
And that actually this dispute between tolerance and intolerance, between the rational and the irrational, between, you know, the light and the dark, you know, that's it's a kind of, it's always been there. It's there as long as there's been human beings. And also it's not even only an external conflict. It's also a conflict within ourselves, that we also have in ourselves both reason and unreason, you know, both the rational and the irrational. And you might even argue that it's not even a good-bad separation, you know, that there's aspects of the irrational which are very creative, and aspects of reason which are very dull. You know? So I wanted just to say, this is who we are.
Yes.
This is our nature. This conflict is our nature, you know? And so the novel is, if you like, just a metaphor of human nature,
yes,
I think, rather than an allegory of the news.
You know? Although there are some things that sound hauntingly from the news,
yeah,
like the one particular djinn who's talking about the creation of a global djinn sultanate.
Yes.
Yes, where they want to prescribe things like poetry, bicycles, toilet paper, fireworks, love stories, political parties, French fries, eyeglasses, root canal dentistry, great list, encyclopedias, condoms, and chocolate, and burning anyone who raises an objection at the stake or chopping them in half, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
That's eerily...
I don't know where I got that. I just made it up.
Yes.
No, I mean, of course, because I think that the fantastic works best in literature when it has a real root in the real.
Yes. You
know? I wanted to say, yeah, of course it does. Of course it does. Of course I'm talking about the world we live in, and it's a version of that. But it's not only that. If it was only that, then maybe it would have been better to write it as a realistic novel. You know? But I was trying, as I say, I was trying to just reach a step further than that.
Well, I'm going to ask one more question and then open it up to two questions for the audience. And my question then is going back to the fairyland, yeah, right, in the book, which is Peristan. And I read an interview where you said that that Kashmir, where your family is from, is like the fairyland of India. And I'm wondering, is Peristan Kashmir? Is that the
well?
Same
I mean,
place?
It's a, well. I mean, except that it's in the clouds. You know,
it's in the clouds.
But
so is Kashmir.
Yeah, in a way. Yeah. But it's well. I mean, Kashmir is an unusually beautiful,
yes,
place, and for people and for people from India, which is hot, mm-hmm, going up in the mountains where it's not hot, is a kind of magic thing. I mean, I remember, because we used to go there as children, we went there every summer, you know, and there would still be snow by the roadside, and like, you would come out of the airport, and on the sidewalk, there was this sort of filthy snow that, you know, had been pushed to one side by motor cars, and people would come out of the airport and grab the snow and say, look, look! As if it was something completely magical,
yes,
because nobody sees snow, you know. I mean, I never saw snow until I first went to Kashmir, and you thought, "What is that stuff?" You know, and it feels like magic. So yeah, I mean, I think it's now, of course, it's a very damaged fairyland because it's now become one of the most contested pieces of ground, you know, in the world. And it's, Kashmir used to be famous for its non-violence. Mm. In fact, people would make jokes about Kashmiris for their peacefulness. And now, of course, it's not like that. So it's a shame.
Well, then in the novel, also the fairyland erupts into violence,
yes,
into war,
yes,
into conflict.
Yes, even there, even fairies want to fight. And even there are conflicts between various tribes of jinn. And in fact, the conflict that spills over onto the earth, mm-hmm, is one that began in the other world because Dunya's father was killed by one of the dark jinn. Mm-hmm. And that's what launches her into a terrible rage. And she sets out to be avenged. You know? And of course, there's a deep ambiguity there, which is that given that I'm trying to say, here's this conflict between the rational and the irrational, but the way the conflict is resolved is by her entering a state of rage, and by there being a war. Mm. And it's as if, you know, I mean, the worst way of saying that is that in order to defeat your enemy, you have to become like them. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think we have some evidence of that too, in our world.
But in the novel, without giving away the ending, it's not a dark ending. In it.
No, because I thought, let's not do that. Oh, that's so easy to do. Mm-hmm. You know, right now, to write a novel in which everything is terrible and then it gets worse and then it ends badly. I mean, that's kind of easy right now, you know. And I thought, because it's easy, don't do it. And what else can you imagine? How else can you imagine that the world might turn out? You know? And the world kind of turns out better than we have any right to expect right now. But remember that it takes 1,000 years to do it. So it's not completely optimistic. It ain't happening anytime soon.
Well, thank you so much, Salman. Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, there will be microphones circulating around,
yeah,
for questions. Does anybody have a question? Raise a hand. Over there? Yes?
Yeah.
And then
over. Oh,
I
not over there.
I went to the back.
Where's it going?
Yes, uh-huh.
Hello, Mr. Rushi. Oh. I hope you can understand my unpleasant British accent. I've already made my mind up on this issue because I'm quite young and inexperienced. So I want to ask someone who is older and wiser. You said you've met a great many politicians in your life. Yeah. Have you actually liked one of them?
Did I like any of them? Yeah, good question. Well, I have to say that Bill Clinton is exactly as charming as you think he's going to be. And very, very seductive. I mean, of men as well as women. And I had a meeting with him in the White House at a very bad time in my life, you know, at the time of real difficulty. And so it was a very tough political meeting. And I went accompanied by this woman who was helping me run the defense campaign, who is now actually the first woman to be the Speaker of the House of Lords, Baroness D'Souza. But back then she was Frances D'Souza running a little human rights NGO and was my kind of sidekick. And Frances is like nobody's patsy. You know, she's been in the Afghan mountains with the Mujahideen. She's been in the jungles of Borneo, etc. She's as tough as they come. And when we left the Clinton meeting, I looked at her, and she had this stupid smile on her face. And I said, Frances, why have you got that stupid smile on your face? And she said, don't you think he held my hand just a little too long? I thought, this guy is a world-class genius. Yes. That he could seduce somebody as hard-boiled as this in the middle of a very tough political meeting. I thought, respect.
Respect.
So, Bill Clinton.
we'll take one here. Yes?
You say the fantastic works best when it's rooted to the real. What's your interpretation of real?
That. I mean, the world is real. You know, there are things that we are born, live, and die in it. You know, if you prick us, do we not bleed? Mm-hmm. You know, so that's what I think. I think there is a world of observable, tangible reality where actions have consequences, and so on. You know, but we also live in an age in which reality is very contested. You know, in which I mean, let's put it like this: that the great novelists of the 18th and 19th century could basically expect that their readers would agree with them about the nature of the world. Mm. Therefore, the nature of the world was not an issue. You could take the world as given and simply set your stories in it. We don't live in that time anymore. We live in a time in which there's a great argument about the nature of the world and about what is the case. You know, you can argue that one of the things that's happening now is different narratives, contesting narratives of what is the case, are in conflict with each other. I mean, you could say that what's happening in the Middle East, for example, is that you have, you know, like an Israeli narrative and a Palestinian narrative, and those narratives are very hard to reconcile. And they are basically both narratives of the same little patch of the earth, mm-hmm. but they are incompatible with each other. You know, so we live in an age now of contested and often incompatible descriptions of reality. And I think that does something to the novel. It does something to how you have to write. You can't, I think, write in that way where you could assume that your readers and you shared a description of the world. Mm. You have to write with a consciousness of the fact that that description is in question, is at issue, you know? And that shifts. I mean, it's a very good question about what is the real. Because I think it shifts our nature, it shifts the idea of the real from something absolutely solid like that to something that's argued about. Mm. You know, and at least what you can do in a novel is to acknowledge that by allowing that argument to be somewhere there.
Another question, we had one over here. Yes.
Hello, thank you so much for that. It was wonderful. Hi, Hector, ¿cómo estás?
Hi.
I wanted to know, how much of your historical training actually informs your fiction writing? Because it seems to me that you were writing the fantastic form to write the historiography of the present.
Yes, I think the fact that I studied history at university was the most important factor in making me the kind of writer that I became. You know, and because historical method, I mean, you forget a lot of history. I mean, I don't, you know, when I was 21, I knew an enormous amount more history than I know now because most of it has faded. But what you remember is historical method. You know, and historical method is the process by which you give meaning to the world. You know, there's one of the great piece of historiography is an essay written by a man called E.H. Carr, which is called "What Is a Fact?" Mm. You know? And it precisely says that, you know, just that something is an event doesn't make it a fact. Mm. A fact is an event with meaning. Mm. And that meaning, again, can be argued about. So even facts are not objective. You know, they're things about which there can be an argument. And I think one of the things when you study history, one of the things you learn, for instance, is that every age of the world remakes the history of the past in its own image. Mm-hmm. If you take, say, the 16th century, and you see how it was written about in the 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st centuries, it could be talking about different people, different places, different times, because we see in the past our concerns, and we look in the past to see how our concerns grew up, and you know, etc. So the past becomes a mirror of the present, you know, in many ways. And so, I think when you learn that history is not objective, it's not set in stone and given, you know, it's a thing you have to make. You have to understand it. That's not so different than imaginative writing, because that's an imaginative act too, you know. And so I've always thought that there are these two narrative lines in my head. You know, one is that historical project, and the other is this that we've been talking about, which is this kind of fabulist project. And I've always thought that the two of them are the best two ways I've found to understand and explain and make vivid what I think about human beings and how we are and what we're up to. You know. And often what I've done in my books is to try and push them both into the same book, you know, to allow that historical narrative to collide with that fabulous narrative and see what happens, you know. And, I mean, so far, so good. You know, some would disagree.
Another question over here, yes?
Where?
Over here.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, this is a question from my son-in-law who could not be here tonight, but also was a history major and is a federal employee. And his question is, what are your thoughts on the future of free speech and by extension literature with the advent of increased Islamic migration into the United States and the West in general?
Well, I mean, I don't think that's necessarily the problem. I think it is... time which is very, in which free speech is under a lot of threat. And there are parts of the world where it's under threat from religious fanaticism, that's true. No. But it's also under threat, I think it's more under threat in America from political correctness. You know, I think it's more under threat from, you know, from like trigger warnings, you know,
yes.
And from, you know, college students who seem to feel they have the right not to read a certain book because it offends their family's beliefs. I mean, it seems to me the reason to go to university is to have your ideas challenged. Mm. You know, the idea that we have to somehow now safeguard our young people from exposure to things that they haven't thought before. I mean, we may as well just shut the universities down, you know. Because the thing that a university should be is a safe place for ideas, not for people's stupid sentiments, you know. And if you're not challenged at university, the university isn't doing its job, you know. Mm. I think we're now living in this age where, unfortunately, a lot of young people accept the idea that offendedness is grounds for censorship, And I mean, I've heard it, I have an 18-year-old son, and I mean, I've heard him and his friends say, well, you know, many of our friends are Muslims and we don't want to offend them. Mm. And I say, well, yes, you know, I believe in politeness too, you know, and I would have brought up my children to be polite. But politeness is not the same thing as free speech. The right to say what you feel is not the same question as whether you should be nice to your friends. You know, and these things get blurred. And I think they are getting, in the age of the internet where everybody says everything to everyone, this idea that offense is a sufficient grounds for banning things is a very dangerous idea, because everything offends somebody. And if offendedness becomes a reason to silence people, none of us can say anything. Mm. You know, there are things that offend me. Mm. I often use the example of the novels of Dan Brown.
Ooh!
And yet, you know, I believe he should be allowed to live.
Another question? Yes. Over here in front, then? Yes. Thanks.
Sorry, Dad.
Just to follow up that,
yeah,
with your historical background, where is this coming from?
Where's what coming from?
This kid's crazy sensitivity. Are they coming up with this on their own? What are the roots of this?
You'll have to ask a younger person. But I feel that there's a certain laziness that derives from living in the lucky part of the world where you've always had the ability to say whatever you want, where for a couple of hundred years anyway, you've had the ability to say what you want without anybody coming after you, you know? And people begin to feel that suddenly they can say, well, certain limitations might be a good thing, you know? And it becomes easy to argue that because you've never had to fight for it, you know? In parts of the world where people have had to fight for the right to say what they want, they understand the value of it, you know? And here, I mean, it's our good fortune that mostly we haven't had to fight for it, you know? But that can lead to a kind of devaluing of it in people's thoughts, precisely because it's just given, you know? It's not struggled for. Mm. And most of the world does not have this good fortune, you know? We do live in the lucky corner, you know? And for that reason, it seems to me very important to go on and on stating that we have this amazing blessing and we need to defend it. Mm. We need to defend it because liberty is not something that just stays. If you don't defend your liberties, there will be people who will take them away from you. You know? I'm making a speech now, but free expression is the freedom without which all the other freedoms disappear. You know, it's the bedrock.
And you say this as someone who has worked to defend the freedom of writers in places where those freedoms don't exist.
Don't exist. I mean, you know, most of the world they don't exist.
They don't exist.
You know, I mean, North America, Western Europe, that's it. Mm-hmm. You know, really, and even there, there's a kind of narrowing. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's very worrying. Because they took centuries to fight for this, you know? And actually, one of the things that's worth mentioning is that given that the American idea of free expression derived from the French Enlightenment, because of Tom Paine bringing the ideas back to America, but the French Enlightenment writers, you know, Voltaire, Rousseau, Montesquieu, Diderot, they were very clear that their enemy was not primarily the state. Mm. Their enemy was the church. Mm. And the Catholic Church of the time, with its enormous power of excommunication and anathema and so on, had great weapons to try and set limits to what could be said. Mm. And the Enlightenment writers quite deliberately set out to challenge the right of the church to do that, and very often used blasphemy quite deliberately as a way of saying, you don't tell us when to shut up. And the victory of the 18th century Enlightenment over the church is the thing which created the modern idea of free expression, of which we are now all the beneficiaries. You know, but it's worth remembering that it was not a battle against the state, it was a battle against the church. And now you could argue different religion, different church, same argument.
Same argument. Yeah. I think we have time for a couple more questions, including one here in front. Yes.
This is a very personal question, and maybe it's why it hasn't been asked. But are you still feeling very threatened? Are you taking personal precautions to?
No, I'm good, thank you.
You're good.
Yeah. No. You could thank you for your concern, but you can chill.
Okay. How many years has it been?
It's been 16 years. It's all right. I mean, I've lived in New York since the year 2000, and it's been just fine. I take the subway, you know. It's cool. Yeah.
But thank you for asking. Thank you for your concern. And I think one last question here. Yes.
Hi. Thank you so much for your presentation tonight. I feel like we live in an age of popcorn brains where we're so distracted, although we're completely engrossed by our phones. And I feel like that's the antithesis of what you need to read a good novel. So I wonder if you could share some thoughts on what you think is the history, the future of writing and the novel.
You know, I'm not as gloomy as that, is the truth. I mean, actually, it's an argument I once had with Gore Vidal years ago, where Gore was talking about, you know, saying it's all over. You know, the younger generation, they don't read anything. They're never going to write anything. They don't care. It's done. You know, it's this thing we've been doing all these hundreds of years, it's dead. And I remember thinking, you know, I'm not sure I agree. But at the time, I hadn't done what I've done now, which is I've now spent the last 15 or 16 years going around American colleges, lecturing, teaching, whatever, you know, meeting very large numbers of young people in different institutions. And I think, you know, there's lots of them that really care passionately about books.
Yes.
And if you look at this strange monster of the internet, there's an enormous number of sites dedicated to conversations about books.
Yes.
And, you know, the internet skews very young, and so those are sites which are run by young people. You know? Now, what I would say is that the reading of books was never a mass market activity. You know, I mean, the audience for literature was never comparable to the audience for an episode of Friends, you know. And it never was, it never will be. But the numbers of people who care about books, I'm not sure that they have diminished at all.
Yes.
You know? And books are unbelievably resilient. You know, in the last 50 or 60 years, so many things have been supposed to kill books. You know, radio is supposed to kill books, television, cinema, you know,
right.
Everything, the internet, the e-book, everything was supposed to kill books, and actually, book sales are up, you know. It's an unbelievably, and I try and explain to my nerdy Silicon Valley friends what an extraordinary piece of software this is. Mm-hmm. That you know, this is very durable, sophisticated, that you can interact with it in many ways. You can insert text, you know, without in any way losing the sense of the original text. And also it has great survival abilities. You know, you could drop this in water and it does not lose its data. You could cover it with sand and its ability to function is really not impaired. You know, so it's actually very, very, very advanced, this. And you know, you should put an apple on it, you know, and then it'll be something worth preserving, perhaps. but I just think it's an amazingly enduring object, the book. And I think, you know, rumors of its demise have been around for a very long time, and it continues to live. I mean, I feel reasonably optimistic about it. But, you know, I could be wrong.
Well, we're here in the temple of the book, the Los Angeles Central Public Library that survived a few disasters. And we have many water-soaked volumes in this particular library. And if you'd like to support the library, please support the Library Foundation. It's a wonderful institution that keeps public libraries going here in Los Angeles. I'm a product of the LA Public Library System. And so thank you so much for coming. And Salman will be signing books outside. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.